Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Be Unique Unscripted, because an authentic life is unscripted. Presented by Bronner House Museum, Elisa Kaler, the spiritual therapist, and Little Green Oasis. Unscripted brings you amazing guests and open mic nights every Thursday night at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an opportunity to learn more. Visit our calendar on beunique.org to see who we have scheduled to appear next. That's BUNEKE.org.
Welcome, everybody, to the show. This is Mary Brotherton, your host. I'm here with Jean Albertson, my partner in crime. Today is a special day because we're actually doing two shows today, one at 2 o'clock and then our regular show at 9 o'clock tonight. So, Jean, are you feeling a little more bobulated now than you were when we first greeted each other?
A little bit. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
He was all discombobulated, so we got the monkey wrench out and we fixed a few things and tweaked it. Today our guest is a professional musician, and he's going to talk about who knows what, because this is unscripted, but I'm going to introduce him. Robert Freeman is a musician, a retired professor, and he has written a book called Woof, A Story of Dogs, Music, and Life. And, I mean, I know you haven't read the book yet, Jean, I don't believe, but it kind of reminds me of your story of you and Bob, because you're a musician as well. So welcome to the show, Robert.
Yeah. I'm delighted to be here. You can call me Bob as well.
Bob, okay.
Okay. That is Jean's. I think we should actually start the show with Jean telling how Bob came into his life, and then we'll talk about some of these goldens that came into your life.
Oh, okay. Well, it was kind of by accident. Someone asked me if I was interested in getting a dog, and I said, well, I'll think about it. And the next morning, the doorbell rang, and I woke up and answered the door, and there was the dog. And my choice was basically, they weren't sounding like he was going to be headed for anything good if I didn't take him. So I never had a dog. He was my first ever. And so we've been trying to get along ever since, learning how to deal with each other. But I got to tell you, I was pondering what his name would be. Didn't know what I'd name a dog. And I was outside in the backyard and leaned over to do something right the day he got there, right when I was thinking of his name. And he fell in the pool, turned around and looked, and he bobbed up. And so I said, that's his name, Bobber. So
that's cute.
So now it's me and Bob.
Bob the human, wouldn't you agree that the best dogs just appear in our lives like that?
Dogs are the most wonderful creatures. I always tell people that I think cats, and I've had some cats too, that cats think of you as staff. Whereas a dog's most fervent wish is to be your friend. If you provide a home and some loving kindness and thoughtfulness and a safe place to sleep and something to eat, the dog will be your friend for life. There's a wonderful article by Malcolm Gladwell of The New Yorker called What the Dog Saw. It's in a book of essays by his, and your listeners can easily find it. It's all of his stuff is very worthwhile. But it says that a dog spends all of his or her sentient activity paying attention to your voice, to the tone of your voice, and to your body motions, because he wants to know, are you at peace? Are you happy? Are you upset about something? Are you angry at him? And what can he do to make you feel better? There's no other animal, including sometimes spouses, that has so keen a sensitivity. But that leads me to what I really want to tell you, which is I've been married twice. I'm now almost 85 years old. The first time for 17, 18 years, at first relatively happily, but then as I got busier and busier professionally with greater and greater strain. And then in 1972, very unexpectedly, I became the fourth director of the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, a place with wonderful possibility, but which I had been severely mismanaged by my immediate predecessor, who was a womanizing alcoholic. So there I am on a new job. I'd never done administration before, and I had a lot to learn and was under a lot of pressure from my boss to move the Eastman School to the other campus of the university, very much against the wishes of the faculty, the students, the alumni, and the community. And so those were tough days for me, especially learning how to do something I'd never done before at my parents' alma mater. It's where my mother and father had met before 42 years. Just before I had gone off, just before that happened, I had gone off on a big concert tour with a young cellist from the Boston Symphony to Europe for a month. That all went very well. But before I left, my first wife said she thought she'd get a dog. And I said, I don't think that's a good idea. You've never had a dog. There's a lot of work there, and you don't like that sort of thing. The dog will make messes, especially if you get a puppy. So I'd advise against it, but she went ahead. She often didn't do what I suggested and got a dog, and then I became Eastman director. I went on a tour then playing Mozart piano concertos all over the country for a couple of weeks, and she came with me. While she was gone, the dog got pregnant. And I said, it's time for an abortion, I think. A pro-choice move. And no, she wanted the children to see that. Just before we were to leave for Europe in the spring, the dog produced 9 puppies.
Wow.
2 days before we were to take off. If it had not
was
been
this
for
a golden?
No, this is a genuine American dog. I'll come to Goldens later. I don't know what we would have done if it hadn't been for my new administrative assistant, Carol, who took care of 10 dogs for the summer at her own expense.
Wow.
She found homes for them all. She got them all shots, got them spayed and neutered, and kept one of the puppies for herself. I don't know what we would have done, but as beginning with that, our relationship changed from professional one to a more personal one, and about 3 years later, we got married.
Wow.
She and I were then married for 42 years, and during the course of that time, we had 17 tenured dogs and a lot of visitors, and my book is the story of those, of all of those dogs.
Wow. Now, did you have one or just over time?
The first one was named Pierre, and he was a genuine American dog. I always use that instead of calling Pierre a mutt or a cur, because like the rest of us Americans, he was a dog of mixed background, mixed racial background. We even think that his brothers and sisters may have had other fathers than he did, but we weren't there to see the conception, so we're not sure, but we strongly suspected that. Pierre had 11 or 12 good years, and then he finally got a problem with his spine and died. There was nothing we could do about that. Meanwhile, we had gotten two other American dogs, one named Annie Sayo, who was a smaller dog, and a large American dog named Oliver Clinton. And then when all of those dogs had passed, Carol was naturally very sad, and we had a friend who had a golden retriever who lived near us, and his golden retriever had just had what he described as her last litter. And so we went to look at that litter, and I let Carol pick out her favorite golden retriever puppy. And that started a parade of golden retrievers. We had 11 of them all together over the course of time, sometimes as many as three at a time. Our last golden retriever was an adopted dog. The first golden retriever was the only one we ever bought from a pet breeder. The rest of them were all from animal shelters, which I strongly advise people to do. There are so many unwanted dogs and cats in the world. People, when you get a pet, you should quickly have it spayed or neutered so that it doesn't reproduce yet more unwanted cats and dogs. Those are so many of them are put down every year unnecessarily. Birth control.
Absolutely, and it's a shame.
I feel that way about human beings too, that it ought to be a mother's right to use her own body reproductively as she wishes, because if she doesn't feel that she's in a position to bear a child, the child isn't going to get the right care, and will grow up having problems, having been abandoned as a child to God knows what. Anyway.
That sounds like a whole nother show there.
That's yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think that children who are wanted and planned do a lot better than children who are abandoned when they're, you know, 6 months old. Not their fault. Anyway, back to dogs. Golden retrievers are very handsome dogs. They're very friendly. They're good looking. They're relatively easy to take care of, and they are certainly very loving. They're good with children. The only bad thing I can say about golden retrievers is that the way you get so-called purebred dogs is by breeding golden retrievers with other golden retrievers, and the result of that is that they all get cancer when they're 10 years old.
Really?
So while our American dogs normally lasted until they were 18, or 20, if you took especially good care of them, it was very hard to get golden retrievers past the age of 10. Which is why
I understand Carol made sure that all of your dogs were properly cared for and fed a very special diet, didn't she?
She took very good care of the 17 dogs and of me. Over 42 years. She passed, alas, a couple of years ago, and I wrote that book when she was in the final stages of breast cancer, and that gave a sort of meaning. It helped her emotionally, I think, at a difficult time in her life to be producing this book together. For good, I say, you remember Billy? What's a good Billy story? Anyway, our last golden retriever came to us with the name Shiner. He was an adopted dog from a rescue league. And in Texas, of course, you know that there's a famous beer here called Shinerbach. And that's probably where his name came from.
Yeah, let's do that.
But since he came with the name of Shiner, and I'm a musician, I thought we would change his name to Shinerbach. And as long as we were going to do that, we called him Shiner Sebastian Bach.
Sure.
The last Christmas Eve of Carol's life, Shinerbach was with us, and I told Carol that I had read somewhere about a German medieval legend that says that if an animal is in the right mood at midnight on Christmas Eve, he or she might speak to us. So we tried to put Shiner Bach in the right mood by giving him a generous cup of Bailey's Irish Cream, which he fully enjoyed, and that put him in the mood to speak with us at midnight. And at midnight,
and what did he say?
What he said at midnight was that a happy dog has owners who love him and take care of him and value his friendship, and that if people could learn how to take care of their pets in that fashion, then they do better at taking care of each other. That his observation was that there's too much hell in the world, and that comes from people not being sensitive enough to each other's feelings.
I need to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to talk about something other than dogs that came up right before the show. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Only once every few years does a show come along that makes you think, makes you care, makes you believe the impossible. A show featuring only the best in writing, acting, and directing. Until that show comes along, we suggest Paranoria, Texas. Thrill to the adventures of six super-powered nerds on a never-ending quest to take over the world and to complete their collection of She-Hulk comics. Paranoria, Texas, Monday nights at 8 p.m. Central on AstronetRadio.com.
We are back. My name is Mary. I'm here with Gene. You hanging in there, Gene? I think I lost Gene.
No, I'm here.
Anyway.
Hey. I was just taking a break.
I want to make sure you're still hanging over there. Speaking of taking a break, in a couple of weeks, everybody can take a break with Gene and Mary at noon every day. We're going to have it's going to start our daily episodes of Take a Break. We'll have more about that on our website, beunique.org. But I want to get back to Bob Freeman, the musician, retired professor, and author. You've written two books. One was called The Crisis of Classical Music in America, and your most recent was called Woof, a love story of dogs, music, and life. But
I have a couple of other books coming out shortly, which I've written in the meantime. Those are musical books.
You've been a busy, busy man.
Well, I'm single now, and while it's very lonely, if there's something to be said for it, it's that you don't have to consult anybody about what you're going to do next.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good thing. I like that you find something good in the loneliness, because that's something that a lot of people can't do. You know, you found your silver lining, I guess.
I found sitting in front of my computer can be fun.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. Gene and I both are writers, and so I get that. And I love Gene's writing. He's new to Be Unique. He writes kind of a stream of consciousness that then I then take and turn into an actual article, which is fun for both of us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he
talks about
work.
What's on his mind. You just give me the thoughts and I make it happen. But that's one of the gifts that I've been given, and I want to take advantage of it.
Of course.
Before the show started, I don't even remember how we got on the subject, but Bob, you mentioned that you once met John F. Kennedy. Was that while he was president?
No. I had the privilege of attending a New England prep school called Milton Academy in Milton, Massachusetts. And when I was in my junior year, in study hall in front of me, there sat John Stevenson, who was Adlai's third son. And one day John said to me, my father, who was running for president for the first time, which of course I knew, is having a rally at the Hotel Statler tonight, and if you want to come in with me, we can have dinner with my dad. And I thought, well, it's thrilling. So I went in with John, and was joined not only by Adlai Stevenson, but by the newly elected senator from Massachusetts, later President Kennedy.
Very nice.
Oh, cool.
Just by the greatest luck, you know, and I've been a Democrat ever since. I am deeply concerned right now about the future of the country, but we don't have to explore that.
And yeah, that comes along with another show, another time.
Yeah.
I think everybody can agree that this is a very tenuous time for our country.
As President Obama said last night at the Democratic Convention, it's very important that we all vote.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep.
And I have to stop and think, you know, back when my great-grandmother was younger than I am, that would have been during the time that women were fighting for the right to vote. And as a woman, I make sure that I vote constantly, and I vote according to my conscience, but I do it in honor of my great-grandmother. She was not she was not a political person. She was a farmer's wife, but she still probably had her own thoughts. I don't remember. I never met her, but I just know that was her era, and I think to do her honor, I would have to make sure that I always vote. And I think this is true for people of, you know, any marginalized portion of our society, whether you're a female or a person of color. It was a long, hard-fought battle to get the right to vote. It wasn't something that we all were born with.
Well, you remember that Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, when he wrote that in 1776, begins with the idea that all men are created equal with the same inalienable rights under God. He does not mention women who didn't get the vote until 100 years ago, and he counted people of color as worth only 60% of a normal human being. But after Lyndon Johnson passed voting rights in the mid-60s, then people of color began to enjoy broader rights at the polls and elsewhere. So we've made some progress, but we still have a long way to go. But the idea that we are we all should have equal opportunities is a wonderful human dream, which the United States has the possibility someday of making real.
Mm-hmm. I have to agree.
Yeah, because
it has the legal framework to do it if we do it as a population.
Now, you wanted to talk some about music and baseball. I have less to say about baseball, except that while I was Houston director, Carol and I were listening to the 79 World Series on television. The Pirates were playing the Orioles, and the Pirates were behind 3-1. Except that in the final three games, a wonderful black man named Willie Sargell hit a home run in each of those games, and the Pirates won. And the TV people were immediately in front of him. "Mr. Sargell, you won the World Series." To which he said, "Come now." He said, "Did you ever try to play baseball by yourself?" He said,
"Good
answer. My team won the World Series." And then he went on to speak about the achievements of several of his teammates and what a good manager they had in Chuck Tanner, and about the ownership and the unemployed steelworkers in Pittsburgh. I thought, this guy not only has a wonderful voice, but he's smart and fast on the trigger and doing things other than hitting home runs. So I conceived immediately the idea of getting a composer on my faculty, a Pulitzer Prize winner named Joseph Schwantner, to write a piece called New Morning for the World. It's 30 minutes long, and it uses texts from Dr. King. And Schwantner wrote the music for this. I had to get the rights for the words from Mrs. King, who called me. Her staff said, "Well, she's very busy, but she'll call you at 2:30 in the morning on Tuesday." So I got up at 2:15 and waited for my phone call, and she came through. And she knew she was talking to the director of the Eastman School. She didn't know about what, but She told me that as a young woman, she had been a soprano, and that she had applied to Eastman and had gotten in, but had gone to the New England Conservatory instead. And she said, if I had gone to Eastman, I would have become a professional singer, maybe at the Metropolitan Opera. But if I hadn't gone to Boston, I would never have met Martin. So I'll give you the rights to the text.
That Willie is amazing.
Willie was hugely wonderful. I paid for him to have training in reciting these texts with the orchestra, and he took it very seriously and did a very dedicated and moving job. We went on a tour with this, which began in the Kennedy Center after a White House reception. And then we played in Philadelphia, Carnegie Hall, Pittsburgh, Boston, Rochester. But the second night we were in Philadelphia, and the critic for the Philadelphia Morning Paper got past my security detail. There is Willie standing in his white tie and black tails, ready to go on stage. And this crummy guy from the newspaper said, Mr. Stargell, this is a temple of high art. Isaac Stern plays the violin here, and Rudolph Serkin plays the piano, and Ormond D. conducts. Knowing how little you must know about classical music, don't you feel kind of embarrassed to be performing in a temple of high art when you don't know anything about music? And I thought, what a terrible thing to say. But
yeah.
Willie had the situation under control. He said to the newspaper guy, is Steve Carlton here? Steve Carlton was a famous pitcher for the Phillies. And the guy said, well, I don't think so. And Willie said, listen, if Steve Carlton were here, there'd be something to be nervous and ashamed about. He struck me out 27 times last season alone. Then he said, but I've been thinking of the question that you raised. And in some ways, classical music performance is very much like baseball playing. In some ways, it isn't. He said, it's like they're like each other in the sense that in both roles, you wear really silly costumes. But he said, they're unlike each other in that my fans in a baseball game know whether I'm succeeding or not. So if I strike out three times in an afternoon, first they boo you, and then they throw rocks and batteries at you. But last night in the Kennedy Center, the conductor said, look, if you screw up some way, just act afterwards as though you swallowed six canaries, and it's a huge success, and embrace me, and I'll embrace you back warmly. And so Willie said, you know, in your business, the fans don't seem to know what's going on, that they clap when you come in, they clap when you finish. Doesn't matter what you did in the meantime.
Yeah.
Later, Willie and I got to be very good friends, and he nominated me to be baseball commissioner. So I didn't get the job. But I did once put on in Rochester, in the home of the Rochester Red Wings, which was the local AAA team, farm team of Baltimore in those days, free to the public evening in a ballpark that seated about 15,000, which was entitled Playing from the Bench, the Role of the Sports Organist. And I had sports organists there from all over the country. And, of course, a lot of people of curious to see what was going on. They all came to the ballpark. The star of the show was an attractive blonde lady named Nancy Faust, who was the regular organist for the Chicago White Sox. And I remember her saying that she had been hired by Bill Veeck, the owner of the White Sox, and told that the White Sox were having a big problem with males streaking across the outfield in the altogether. And management would appreciate it if Miss Faust could figure out what kinds of repertory she could play that would discourage that practice. She said, the first time it happened when I was playing, I played I've Got Plenty of Nothing. And she said, you know, it only happened one other time And the second time I played, "Is That All There Is?" And she said,
"No way."
People
like
know
her.
Those songs. And that stopped the practice. And management said, they gave me a big raise.
That's funny.
Good for her.
And
it was reviewed in Newsweek, Page in Newsweek, and I was reviewed on the Joe Garagiola show. I became a real baseball celebrity for a week.
That's awesome.
That's
but the main thing
cool.
we should talk about is music, which is where what I've spent my life doing. My mother and father were professional musicians. They met as students in the late 20s at the Eastman School in Rochester, and they thought that they had miseducated there. And it was a piece of great irony that I became the director in 1972, a position which I held for 24 years, and through which I really had an important role in changing the way in which musicians are educated and trained.
Awesome.
So that's what my life is about. My avocational life is about baseball and dogs.
Well, I think it's interesting.
I'd say, go ahead, Jane.
Well, I just was thinking, you were talking about in reading about some of your works, you had talked about the future of classical American classical music being in question as compared to what it's been. And one of the things I think was interesting, you had talked about students wanting to go into classical music to maybe being very careful about how they pick their instruments. And what, you know, to be able to pursue classical music, but perhaps flesh it out for some other forms of vocation.
Yeah, that certainly has been an important point of mine. I think people who are parents of kids and teenagers, it's a wonderful thing to have your sons and daughters study music. Piano is a wonderful place to start, but so are the other instruments as they reach their teens. Being able to play a string quartet with friends your own age, or in an orchestra or band with kids who admire your playing and with whom it's fun to play, can be a wonderful experience. And what happens is that a lot of students then fall in love with music and want to become musicians without understanding that it's a terribly competitive field. We're presently producing 35,000 music degrees, collegiate music degrees, a year.
Mm-hmm.
And there certainly aren't anything remotely like 35,000 jobs. So I have been for a long time stressing the idea that you might take a five-year undergraduate degree. So music and medicine, or music and law, or music and technology, and music and business. So that in the long run, you might decide that you're not going to join the Philadelphia Orchestra, but you're a physician, and you make your living doing that, and you have fun playing string quartets and going to concerts. That's been sort of that, and the fact that for a long time, musicians thought they didn't need, they were told from the time of the French Revolution that all they needed to do was practice their violins and they would succeed. They didn't need to learn how to read and write, they just needed to learn how to play.
Right.
I have just written a book with Leonard Slatkin, famous American conductor, which will be out next year, in which we stress important changes in the education of musicians and thus in the way musicians are chosen for orchestras, for example. Leonard got me started thinking about a famous maxim of Duke Ellington, because Leonard and I are trying to get rid of the term classical music, or putting any qualitative aspect of calling it good music or concert music, or not quite sure what to call it. But what's called classical music in the United States is mostly music by dead European white males.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Sure. Whereas and there is less and less of a market for that, which is a shame because it's great music, all right. But it was the black population that invented jazz, in which wasn't even taught in American music schools until after Lyndon Johnson passed voting rights legislation in the 1960s. Jazz, as such, was only taught in American music schools beginning in 1968 at Indiana, Eastman, and New England. Duke Ellington said, there's good music, and then there's the other stuff. What he did not define is what the good music is. That what I think is the good music is good as far as I'm concerned, and it may be what you think is good, and it may not be. But that doesn't
right.
make you a lower
exactly.
quality human being just because you like different repertory.
Sure.
So
exactly. Because, you know, there are so many different genres of music. You know, you've got electronic dance music, you've got Baroque, you've got jazz and country music, and then you've got pop culture type music. Yeah, you can't qualify or quantify.
On the same line, a man named Gunther Schuller was one of my predecessors as president of the New England Conservatory, a famous American composer, conductor, administrator, horn player, jazz musician, classical musician. Gunther could do everything and do it very well. When he started as New England Conservatory president in the late 60s, he invented something called Third Stream, which he announced would be a hybrid between classical music and jazz, a kind of music which had qualities of both of those repertories. Gunther was a friend, and in 1999, I had the privilege of having lunch with him, and I asked him, well, what do you think about Third Stream now? And he said, well, that was a good idea in 1970, but in the meantime, tens of thousands of young musicians have come to the United States to study from all over the world, and with them, they have brought their own music, of course, and they
right.
not only learned our music, but they learned each other's music. And so
mm-hmm.
it's not a question of Third Stream anymore. He said those three streams of 1970 are now creating an ocean which has about 50 different rivers flowing into it and mixing with each other. Excuse me. So the question of what's good music is a complicated one. And my friend Leonard Slatkin advocates the idea of, even with regular symphony orchestras, playing a much broader repertory. Leonard grew up in Los Angeles. His parents were both gifted string players. But when he was at home, while I grew up in Boston, where which calls itself the hub of the universe, which is a little hyperbole,
yeah.
but it has the Boston Symphony and NEC and Harvard and MIT and all of that. So Boston is proud of itself, and there's a bust of Beethoven over the Proscenium Arch at Symphony Hall. Whereas Leonard grew up in Los Angeles, and while his parents had a wonderful string quartet, which won Grammys, they knew all kinds of musicians because they made their living playing music for the films. So coming over to the Slatkin's home for dinner were not only Stravinsky and Schoenberg, but Art Tatum and Nat King Cole and Duke Ellington and George Shearing, just the broadest array of Frank Sinatra, of very gifted musicians who were involved in other kinds of music. And so Leonard still does that. I was with him in Rochester last fall, and he conducted a whole concert of music by an Eastman graduate named Jeff Beal, who was primarily a film composer. It's just making.
And I think
the film
industry has opened a lot of people's eyes to different kinds of music. I can remember as a child watching cartoons like Mickey Mouse with Fantasia. That was nothing but this old European music we were talking about.
Well, that was wonderful. Stokowski, Leopold Stokowski, the long-term conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra, who was trying to sell classical music to a broader number of people. That happened, in a sense, during the Second World War, where a very bright guy at RCA, named Sokolov, had the idea of hiring Toscanini to conduct an NBC symphony. And the reason he was interested in Toscanini is that in 1936, Toscanini had stood up to Adolf Hitler at Bayreuth. And Sokolov thought there's a war coming on, and we can use the war as a way of selling classical music to the American public on the radio. And they did.
Wow.
But they didn't sell the music so much as they did Toscanini as a war hero. So when Toscanini died, the NBC Symphony died with it. It's a wonderful book on the rise and fall of classical music in America by an author named Joseph Horowitz, which I recommend warmly to all of your readers. You want to find out about the history of Beethoven and Wagner in the United States, Horowitz is the place to go. It's a good read.
And what's the name of the book?
I'll tell you another interesting story, as long as we're on that matter. There's a recent terrific book called The Carl Mook Scandal by a lady named Melissa Burridge. When the Boston Symphony was founded in 1881, and until 1919, it was conducted by nothing but Germans and Austrians. But, of course, there was the First World War, intense anti-German feeling, and in 1918, the FBI arrested the then music director, Carl Mook, and interned him in a prisoner of war camp in Georgia, and sent him back then to Germany after the war, where he had a hard time in a country which was just divided economically and politically in a million pieces. But he was a good Wagner conductor, and he made friends with Cosima Wagner at Bayreuth, the festival of Wagner's works in the summertime there in the Bavarian city. And in that fashion, Carl Mook got to know Adolf Hitler, who came regularly as a guest to Bayreuth as well, and because of their friendship, named one of his dogs Mook. There aren't very many dogs named after famous conductors.
No.
No, not many. I'll be right back. I have to take another real quick commercial break.
Okay.
Let me ask you a question. Do you prefer coffee or tea? This is a question we ask on our fun and informative millennial talk show called Coffee or Tea, No Phones Allowed. And why do I know? Because I'm Anna. I'm one of the co-hosts. It's a great time. It's a professionally edited weekly series that's free to watch on Be Unique's YouTube channel. That's B-U-N-E-K-E. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode and leave us a comment with your topic or guest recommendations. We love hearing from you.
Anna is also the host of another one of our podcasts on Tuesday, every other Tuesday night. And I believe next Tuesday is one of the others. She has a show called Here I Am at 8 o'clock. Anybody who wants to know more about that should visit beunique.org and check out our calendar to see who our upcoming guests are. But we are back today, finishing up the show. We've got about 10 minutes left. We're talking with Bob Freeman, musician, retired professor, lover of dogs, lover of life, actually. And if you haven't read Woof, A Love Story of Dogs, Music, and Life, it's a real quick, fun book to read. Only about 60 pages, and it's full of pictures of his dogs with great little stories and anecdotes about his 17 different dogs that he's had in his lifetime, along with his wife, Carol. We were talking just before the break about the, I think we had mentioned the Wagner festivals over in Bavaria, Austria.
Yep. No, in Germany. In Bavaria.
Germany, okay.
Well, it's about 100 miles northeast of Munich.
Okay. Yeah, I remember reading about the festival, and I always thought that would be a great place to go sometime just because the music would be amazing.
Yeah,
and I think the last thing you mentioned was that Muck was a composer. Was he a composer?
Conductor.
Conductor. And had a dog named
German conductor of the Boston Symphony, who ended up getting to be friends with Hitler.
Okay. Well, you named your dogs some very unusual names. You didn't call them Spot or, you know,
Rover. No, we spent a lot of time. We spent a lot of time. We usually used Oliver Clinton, for example, was named. I had a professor at Princeton who was unfriendly and tough on his students. And so I thought having Oliver, so I could say, "Oliver, sit down," would be fun. And his second name was Clinton, because that was the name of a important street in Rochester where we had found him as a stray dog. But I'd like to spend a little bit of time we have left talking to your listeners about the importance of music study for young people.
Sure.
Okay.
There is a terrific book by a UCLA professor, which, I don't know, you can buy for $3 or $4 used these days, by a professor named James Catterall, Catterall, the title of which is Doing Well and Doing Good by Doing Art. What he does is studying 20,000 kids in the Los Angeles school system over, I think, about 5 years, separating those who studied music and drawing and dancing and acting from students who didn't. There were about, among the 20,000 people, there were equal numbers of both. Kids who had done art in school and kids who had not done art in school. And what he found was that the ones who had done art in school, by a fairly considerable margin, did academically better than the others. They did better in graduating from high school. They did better in getting into college. They did better in graduating from college and getting good jobs than the ones who weren't involved in art. And the amazing thing about this is, irrespective of socioeconomic background. That's to say, the kids whose parents had money did better than the kids who didn't have money. But the kids who didn't have money, if they did art in school, did markedly better than the other kids from that background. That's something
makes
that everybody
sense.
ought to read and think about.
Sure.
Because too many American school systems have abandoned music and the other arts as part of the curriculum, and it's a huge mistake. There's Catterall's book, but let me go on. I had a very good high school education at Milton Academy. I knew that I couldn't stay there since I was on scholarship unless I got all A's, so I worked hard, but my parents saw to it that I also had oboe lessons and piano lessons and music theory lessons. That was to take up time over the weekend, and I had an hour on the bus each way getting to Milton Academy between there and home. So I was pretty busy. There was no time for dating. There was no time for smoking. There was no time for drinking or drugs. I was busy. And one of the things that you're doing in music always is trying to get to make the product better. So you're developing wonderful neurological skills in coordination between your eyes and your hands and feet and your ears. And that turns out to have a very positive effect on the development of your brain, which comprises a bunch of circuits, like billions of circuits connecting different parts of your brain with one another. And being able to play the piano, well, I'll tell you another story. I'm on the board of something at Houston called the National Society for Human Performance. They're looking at all aspects of that. I heard a paper over there by a physician, an orthopedic physician. The title of this paper was Solving the Female Dance Triangle. That makes sense to you? What in the world is that about? He had,
I'm sitting here spinning my brain.
He had an equilateral triangle as a teaching aid, and the top of the triangle at the apex, he puts up a sign which says, telling 12-year-old female dancers that the only way they can succeed is by staying thin, so they should eat nothing but lettuce.
Oh.
And then in the lower, left-hand corner, it says, delayed onset of menstruation by 2 to 3 years. And in the lower right-hand corner, it says, he adds, career-ending falls at the age of 20. That's amazing.
And broken bones because they consume no calcium and boron, magnesium.
Exactly. I mean, it all goes together. I heard another paper which was given by a guy who was running our drone program in the Air Force. The good thing about the drone program is that when one of them crashes, our people aren't hurt. So the bad thing is that it causes a lot of damage if it lands in the wrong places and kills other people who we don't want to have killed. So the Pentagon spent a lot of money. There are two guys operating the drones. They're on an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. It's Gene and me. Gene is in charge of synthesizing 25 incoming video signals from the drone, and I'm in charge of doing the same thing with audio signals. I have my own 25 signals, and I'm supposed to integrate those and then discuss with Gene what he sees, and we're supposed to give the drone guidance enough for that to avoid a crash. And we're not doing it. So the Pentagon spent an enormous amount of money trying to figure out which Americans were best at synthesizing under pressure multiple incoming variables of one kind or another. And the answer turned out to be piano players.
Musicians. Oh,
sure.
Really?
Especially pianists and organists.
Interesting.
So the development of new kinds of neurosciences has become... Music has become of great interest in the last 25 years as a field to study by neuroscientists because they can take photographs of people's brains as the result of magnetic resonance imaging to see what's going on in the brain while Van Cliburn was playing the Third Rachmaninoff Concerto. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, very much.
I recall recently
in a surgery, a brain surgery, that the patient was asked to play the flute, and playing the flute during the surgery allowed them to concentrate on certain parts of the brain that to basically guide their surgery.
Yeah,
I thought that was fascinating.
There are three centers for such things right now. One is at Houston. The most important one is in the Texas Medical Center in Houston, which I just told you about. But the Eastman School has started one in Rochester with the Medical Center of the University of Rochester, and there's another one that I've been the board chair of for some time until recently called the Institute for Music and Brain Science at UCLA. And I hope there'll be more of the same, because it's a very interesting field of study on the subject of how the human brain works.
Yes.
Well, you know.
And what I was going to say is our upcoming issue of Be Unique, which comes out in September, we actually have an article about synesthesia. And that's a neurological condition where the stimulation of one pathway leads to involuntary experiences. In this particular case, a woman hears music and she paints these amazing paintings.
And her paintings. Famous Russian composer in the first 15 years of the century just passed, named Scriabin, who a very good composer, but he claimed that as he was listening to music and composing it, he saw various kinds of colors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I totally believe that.
We all used to think that Scriabin was just crazy, but he's been given a new birth of interest, I think, in the last 15 years.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that I was just gonna say, no doubt in my mind that music is huge. I mean, for me personally, I will say that during my middle school, junior high years, that it helped keep me out of jail. Orchestra did.
Wow.
Dr. Schoen wouldn't have no monkey business. So if I was gonna stay in the orchestra, I had to make my business good, and I did. It really made the difference in my life. So
yes, sir. If you got
and
two
I know there
left,
are a lot
I'll
of
tell
people...
you about George Eastman.
Well,
go for it.
Okay.
Mr. Eastman was born in rural upstate New York near Utica in, I think, 1854 to a farming family. His father died when he was 5. He never went to college. There was no money to do that. His father told him to take care of his mother, and he did. Eventually, they moved to Rochester when he was about 18, and by the time he was in his early 20s, he had founded what turned out to be Kodak. His mother lived until he was 58, and then he spent 2 years trying to figure out what he would do with the rest of his life, and decided he didn't want to get married. He would just give away about $1 billion, which he did by founding MIT to start out with and putting it on the north shore of the Charles River Basin, and then founding his music school in Rochester, the Eastman School, and founding the medical center for the University of Rochester, giving money to black colleges in the South, founding dental clinics for little kids all over the country, and ending in 1929 by forming a George Eastman professorship at Oxford University, which is to be given each year to a distinguished American for just 1 year only, because he thought that the Brits didn't take Americans seriously enough, and he wanted to demonstrate American talent to the British. Having a very severe kind of spinal cancer and being single with no family, he decided when he was 80 years old that there was no cure for this. And so after listening to his morning organ music in March of 1932, he went upstairs, wrote a note which says, "To my friends, my work is done. Why wait?" and shot himself in the heart.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
A dramatic story that I'd love to see a feature-length movie made for.
Yeah.
There's a lot of components in there.
Yeah.
That's it's dramatic and it's tragic, but it's also practical if you think about it. He chose his own time.
Yep.
And my youngest son has often said that.
American Horatio Alger.
Yes. Yes.
A demonstration, if you work hard enough and try hard enough at something, you can do practically anything.
Yeah.
Indeed.
That's pretty true.
Well, our hour is up. And I want to tell you that at the end of our show, every time Gene and I get together, now we're not going to do this on Take a Break, but on our Thursday shows, we always leave with a parting word. And I would like to start by saying, if you think you can't play a musical instrument, you can always dance to somebody else's music.
it's fun to play a musical instrument.
It is.
And if you start it when you're 10 or 12 years old, you can get pretty good at it. That does not mean that you have to be a professional.
Right.
No.
You can have fun.
But you can have fun. And that's the way we train kids with sports. I mean, playing baseball when you're 15 years old is a good thing to do. It does not mean that you have to play for the Yankees.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, I sure have had fun with music in my life. Started off with a saxophone, some different woodwind instruments, and did the harmonica for a while. And what I've ended up with is the recorder. And I just really like it. It doesn't take as much wind in my old age. But I just enjoy it. It's like sometimes if I just get so stressed I can't handle it, I can take my recorder and 3 minutes later, I'm better. It's
feeling better.
Done.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's all it takes. So, sure has been a joy talking to you.
It changes your synapses in your head.
We had a good conversation.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it very much. We learned a lot, and our listeners in 39 different countries have learned a lot.
Terrific.
Really appreciate you taking time with us today. So, Bob, do you have any closing words before I?
Yeah, the closing words are those of the Shiner told us on Christmas Eve. If we can focus on not ourselves, but looking after each other and after our pets, it'd be a better world.
Amen.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Amen.
Shiner.
Yep.
All right. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
See you then, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening this evening. We're happy you chose to spend this time with us, and we hope you learned as much as we did.
Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
And if you'd like us to invite you or someone you know to speak right here, just go to beunique.org and contact us there.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that our newly branded podcast has so many global listeners and that our website and magazine receive thousands of visitors each month. Let's put your brand in front of all those people. Mary can share the demographics with you. Contact her through the website. That's BUNEKE.org.